I'm being completely honest now, okay? Homelessness makes me uncomfortable. But then I think, at least it's not sleeping on the sidewalk with everything I own uncomfortable.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
Today on Rainbow Country, award-winning broadcaster and the recipient of the Order of Canada, Jeannie Becker. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbecue.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada, as well as being a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. And all of that is thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. So today, award-winning fashion and lifestyle journalist and the recipient of the Order of Canada, Jeannie Becker is my guest and joins me to talk about receiving the 2025 Hollywood Reporter Impact Award. We'll also talk about her 27 years on fashion television, as well as the new music. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some classic new wave, some queer jazz, and more. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country and our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, best-selling Canadian author Anthony Badalka reads from his 12th novel, Going to Beautiful, a book that tells the story of married gay couple and parents, Jake, a celebrity chef, and Eddie, a fashion designer. They had it all until they didn't.
Probably one of the most horrific things imaginable had befallen me. I'd been struck down with a man cold. So I was holed up in the guest bedroom of the home I share with my husband Eddie and beloved French bulldog Lulu. I heard a faint tap, tap, tap on the bedroom door before it inched open. This let in blazing shafts of cornea-torching hellfire, also known as dim lighting from the hallway. Now, despite mentioning the hellfire thing in what was probably an unkind way, Eddie came in anyway. He gently lowered himself onto the edge of the bed and expressed concern. Lulu was markedly less empathetic. Eddie rubbed my arm. I saw his kind smile and closed my eyes. A while later, I felt his hand on my forehead, testing my temperature. I must have passed the test because he leaned in, kissed me where his hand had been, and whispered, "You're going to be all right, my love." I don't remember either Eddie or Lulu leaving the room. A while later, I awoke and realized that in my end-of-day stupor, I'd unwisely left my arsenal of medications in the kitchen. No, I mean, maybe I'd done it on purpose. A heap of pills was sure to elicit sympathy and vigilance. They might even inspire Eddie to stock the fridge with mint chocolate ice cream for when I needed it as life-saving sustenance. I tightened a blanket around me for the lengthy journey to the kitchen. I was not convinced I'd make it. Halfway there, I fell against a floor-to-ceiling window, luxuriating in the coolness of the glass against my sizzling cheek. I considered stripping down and plastering my naked body against the pane, but just the thought set my teeth to chattering. If I was going to make it back to bed before daybreak, I knew I had to keep going. In the kitchen, I found my stash of meds, swallowed some, downed 2 glasses of water, checked the freezer for mint chocolates. Disappointed, I set out on my return death march, propelled only by the promise of a warm bed. That was when I noticed it, a flickering light. The flickering light was coming from the other side of the sliding glass door that separates the living room from our expansive outdoor terrace. I took a shaky step towards the light. Wait a second. Isn't that what happens when you're dying? Was I dying? Did I feel compelled to step into the light? Had I taken too many drugs? I checked for a pulse. Seemed strong enough. It was too early for Eddie to have gone to bed, yet there was no sign of him or Lulu in the apartment. Could they be out there, on the balcony, at night, in March? I mean, the weather had been unseasonably warm that week. And, you know, sometimes when that happened, we'd bundle up in the hand-knit sweaters we'd brought back from Ireland, prepare brandy-spiked hot chocolates, crank up the space heaters, and with fragrant steam wafting off our boozy drinks, our noses reddening, our breath dancing in the air, we'd cuddle up on the couch and giggle and laugh and pretend we were two burly fishermen who'd found love on the Irish moors or some such nonsense. So they have to be out there, right? Satisfied with the explanation for the flickering light and convinced I wasn't dying just yet, I turned and headed for bed before the NyQuil kicked in. I was halfway down the hallway when that itty bit of rationality that still lurked in my congested head told me to stop. Eddie would be worried about me. He was sweet that way. As a good husband, I should poke my head outside and announce my status as still breathing. I owed him that much, even if he hadn't brought me the ice cream. With the blanket wound tightly about me, I did a geisha walk from hallway to balcony door. The first thing I noticed through the glass was Lulu, frantically pawing at it. Was she out there alone? Had Eddie somehow forgotten her out there and gone to bed after all? I strained to see out, but saw no sign of him. I slid open the door. Lulu rushed inside, shooting me a belittling look. I stepped onto the balcony, grimacing as my bare feet made contact with the cold floor. It was quiet. Too quiet. Now on the balcony, I saw that the flickering light I'd seen from the kitchen was coming from a statuesque liquid lava lamp, which, according to our interior designer, we couldn't possibly live without. But where was Eddie? Despite protective layers of quilting, I felt a chill, and not the fever-induced kind. I moved forward and called out, "Hello?" "Hello," came the response. And there he was, Eddie, standing in heavy shadow. For several seconds, we just stared at one another. "How are you?" he finally asked. I mean, did the pile of drugs in the kitchen tell him nothing? And had he looked in on me earlier in the bedroom and found me half dead? Or did I hallucinate that? "You should go back to bed," he said. "Go back to bed." I mean, was I disturbing his evening? It may have been the fever, but his apathetic suggestion really ticked me off. I mean, where was the caring? Where was the worry? Where was the goddamn mint chocolate ice cream? Now, thankfully, before I said any of that, I remembered the sage advice of our neighbor and good friend, Baz. She said, "If you don't have anything nice to say, mumble it under your breath and walk away." And that's exactly what I did. And that's exactly the last time I ever saw my husband, Eddie.
At first, we didn't believe it. I was doing the international news for the Body Politic when I read a report in an American paper about a strange new cancer that was apparently affecting gay men. More sensationalized media homophobia, I thought. Didn't turn out that way. Some Body Politic Collective members were back and forth to New York and soon reported that something serious was indeed going on. Guys who had seemed quite healthy months before were suddenly dying. Nobody knew what was happening, so everybody got to project their own prejudices on the blank slate of AIDS. If you were an environmentalist, it was obviously big city pollution. If you didn't like paupers, it was caused by paupers. If you didn't like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it was too much sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Maybe it was all that sperm up our bums. If you were a fundamentalist Christian, it was obviously God's punishment, the wages of sin is death, and so on and so on. What we did know was that somehow it was connected to sex. That was bad news for those of us in the business of sexual liberation. We saw a whole community based on sexual networks potentially falling apart. We feared everything we'd built up over a decade was about to be destroyed, not to mention that we were all going to die. New York and San Francisco were already in a panic. Larry Kramer was screaming that we were fucking ourselves to death. Baths and sex clubs across the U.S. were being closed down. There were no effective medicines. If you had it, it was just a matter of time before you died. Government was doing fuck all, so we had to figure this out for ourselves. In 1983, the community came together to form the AIDS Committee of Toronto and began to organize care teams and support groups. Then HIV was identified. For the first time, we knew this was a blood-borne virus that could be sexually transmitted. ACT took on prevention campaigns. What squared the circle of sexual liberation versus a deadly sexually transmitted disease was safe sex. Condoms came to our rescue. We could still have sex, just had to use a rubber. AIDS in Toronto was born in the shadow of the bath raids, remember? We had just moved heaven and earth to defend these places. We weren't about to let them close down now. So while baths and clubs were being shuttered south of the border, ACT demanded there be no such closures in Toronto. Baths here remained open and became sites of outreach and education, and they're still open today. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Jeannie Becker.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara. Rainbow Country.
Becker. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well. I am well. I am honored to have you here, Jeannie Becker. I feel like I know you even though that I don't know you.
I know. Isn't that the wonderful thing about having been on TV for, you know, how long now has it been for me? Like, I don't know, half a century or something? Well,
And still going strong today. Okay, let's start here. Created to recognize the positive impact of Canada's very own trailblazers who have changed the narrative for women in media. The Hollywood Reporter's Impact Award, you, Jeannie Becker, will be receiving the 2025 The Hollywood Reporter's Impact Award. How does that make you feel?
Well, you know, branding makes such a difference, doesn't it? You know, I guess because it's branded Hollywood Reporter and, you know, we kids who grew up in this country at a time when we really looked south of the border and thought of the U.S. as, you know, those big, rich, fancy kids that we only could aspire to be like. I mean, believe me, the sensibility has changed a lot, especially recently. But because, you know, as an aspiring young actress, I got into the acting professionally at the age of 16. And I would go to L.A., you know, over the years, and I would always like scoop up a copy of the Hollywood Reporter and I would take it to a little cafe and I would sit there and read the industry news and, you know, over a cappuccino, feeling very grown up and important. And I think because this is dubbed a Hollywood Reporter Award, it almost adds a certain amount of gravitas to it for me, you know. But at any rate, it's always a wonderful honor to be recognized as some kind of a trailblazer, for sure. And I did have the opportunity to blaze a lot of trails. I mean,
whether it's fashion, whether it's music, you have been there on the forefront in my little gay humble opinion, Jeannie Becker. Did this honor come as a surprise to you?
Yeah. Because last year, when they instituted this specific award in Canada, I was very dismayed that I hadn't even been invited to the ceremony and I never even knew anything about it. I mean, I was just like, all of a sudden I heard, oh, there are these big Hollywood Reporter, you know, awards going on. And I think at the time, you know, the award that I'm getting was given to Sophie Trudeau. And I thought, well, that's nice, you know, I mean, but I felt, you know, I thought I wasn't even invited to the awards show. I didn't even know what was going on. I mean, I would have gladly bought a ticket, but no one told me about it until, you know, it was too late. So when they phoned this year, was it a phone call or maybe, no, actually, maybe it was some kind of letter that I got through my agent, you know, but when it was like, wow, you're kidding. I was very, very excited and, you know, shocked and amazed.
So Jeannie Becker, something else that you will be impacting, it is simply this. Project Runway Canada, it's coming back. Mm-hmm. You will be a judge on this new revamped version. It will be airing on Crave TV. What can you share about this up-and-coming revamped version of Project Runway Canada?
Well, I'm just thrilled that we're doing it. It's being shot at TMU's Fashion School, which is a great location. You know, that's a school, formerly Ryerson, that had really trained a lot of very successful Canadian designers, and a place that I actually even taught a course at several years back. So it's being shot in my own backyard, in a sense, in downtown Toronto, which is great. Coco Rocha, love her. She's going to be hosting and also judging. And, you know, I think I was at Coco's very first Paris runway show at the Jean-Paul Gaultier show when she danced an Irish jig. So I really watched her kind of grow up over the years in the trenches of fashion. She actually wrote a foreword for one of the kids' books that I wrote about modeling, strutting it, the grit behind the glamour. So I've had a long-standing love affair and relationship with Coco Rocha. So that'll be great working with her. I don't yet know who the other, there's going to be one other judge full time. There will be a series of guest judges as well, of course. And there's going to be a mentor, of course. And they haven't announced that yet. So I don't even know who that's going to be. But it's going to be great fun. I think now more than ever is the time to really wave our flags, you know, as Canadians. So important. When they did a couple of seasons of Project Runway Canada several years back, I think maybe it was like
2007. Yeah.
They had approached me, but I couldn't take part because I was working for fashion television at the time, and that would have been a kind of conflict, or, you know, in terms of the broadcaster I was working for and then the broadcaster that would have aired Project Runway Canada. So I couldn't do it, and it was like, oh, shucks. But this is going to be great. I'm really excited. I mean, I was a judge for a couple of seasons on Canada's Next Top Model, so I kind of, you know, have a feel for that, you know, reality show judging thing, and I've been a guest judge on the Canada's Drag Race. But I must say that it is a little, I don't know, it's a little sad because sometimes, especially in these creative arenas, like especially with something like fashion, it's such a subjective thing. And it's, you know, comparing apples and oranges, and it so much has to do with the personal taste level. So I just hope that we can award a prize to someone who really shows serious possibility in becoming a successful Canadian designer, which is no easy feat.
Well said, well said. So we're talking impact, we're talking fashion. Let's move on to, of course, the 2025 Met Gala. The theme was essentially dandyism, which dates back to around the 19th century, where certain men would pay attention to their fashion, to their appearance, and it really centered around, I think it's fair to say, black men, in particular gay men. In her May 2025 editor's letter, Anna Wintour talked about Andre Leontali, a former editor-at-large of Vogue magazine, a fashion stylist and author, a larger-than-life personality gone way too soon. And she called him a dandy among dandies. You, Jeannie Becker, I believe interviewed Andre Leontali at one point.
You know, over the 27 years
of fashion television.
Fashion television ran, I think I must have interviewed him like 27,000 times.
What was he like?
Yeah, we had a great relationship. He was wonderful. I absolutely adored him. You know, he was a little troubled, and certainly, you know, there's something very sad about Andre. I remember the last interview that I did with him, the last sort of long, you know, sit-down interview I did with him. It was around the time that his documentary film was playing at the Toronto International Film Festival. And he told me just how he'd never had love in his life. Love, like love from a partner, like a romantic, you know, sexual kind of love that had always eluded him, a relationship of that nature. And my heart just absolutely broke for him because he had so much love to give. And that was really sad that he talked about that. He also had his share of challenges with Vogue, with Anna Wintour in particular. I mean, they were very fast friends initially, and then they had a huge falling out. And, you know, he spoke quite openly about it in his brilliant memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, you know. But I'm glad to see that his spirit and his legacy was really honored in this way by presenting a show of this nature at the Met. I am also, though, a little disappointed that people didn't quite, most people didn't quite rise to the occasion, because Andre was like larger than life. And I felt this was a very reserved dress-up occasion compared to previous Met balls.
Well said. Especially coming from you. Fashion television launched in 1985. We were just talking about you interviewing Andre Leontali a number of times. fashion television aired in what, over 130 countries over 27 years. How did Jeannie Becker and Fashion Television FT come to be? How did this all happen?
Oh, well, that's a whole long story. That's, you know, it just really started with an idea that a very brilliant young producer in the promos department of City TV had, Jay Levine. He, you know, grew up with a mom who was very fashion conscious, and he saw the excitement that fashion could generate, and he thought it was a darn sexy thing. You know, he had a real penchant for, you know, gorgeous young women, as a lot of guys do. But he decided that it could be really cool to put a show out there that would really explore fashion, the sexiness of fashion, and not necessarily to get too esoteric and deal with it, you know, as a, you know, like hemlines and silhouettes and fabrications, but really just talking about like the spirit and the energy of fashion, which is very cool. And he wanted to do like a fashion video show, because at that time, so we're talking about the mid 80s, all of a sudden, some designers started producing these fashion videos, hoping that they would do for their business what music videos had done for musicians and their businesses. Mm-hmm. But there weren't really any vehicles for these fashion. So I, at the time, was still hosting the New Music. Mm-hmm. And we would get these fashion videos sent to us, like Moses Neimer, the brilliant media visionary who ran City TV, would send over these fashion videos and say, you know, put them on, you know, put them on the New Music, like, because they're really cool, but we don't have anywhere else to really show them. So just put them on, you know. And we thought, okay, well, it didn't really make sense. But all of a sudden there was Jay going, no, we should create a special vehicle where we can show these fabulous fashion videos. So when I heard rumblings of a show about fashion, I mean, listen, I was a girl who grew up in the 60s, like in love with fashion. I was always a little fashionista. And I thought, wow, I was looking for the next big thing, because I'd been working in the rock and roll scene for quite a few years and I was ready for the next big thing. And I put myself forward as a host of this show. And I said, you know, but instead of just showing these fashion videos, why don't we go and talk to some of these designers? We could go backstage. We could go into the studios. We could go behind the scenes and do with them what we used to do with the musicians on the New Music. And they were like, no, we don't really want any talking heads on this show. This is just really going to be about, you know, sexy, you know, eye candy. So I said, okay, whatever you want to do, I'm there. I really want to do it. And I really petitioned for, really lobbied to get this. They wanted to give it to a model, like a young, you know, model. They weren't looking at me, you know, someone who, not that I was that old at that point, but by that point, I guess I was like, you know, early 30s. You know, I had sort of, I'd already been around a little bit. And I think they were really looking for a model. But I said, no, you owe it to me. I've worked so hard. Come on, I'm looking for the next big thing. So finally, they said, okay, we'll let you host the pilot. So I hosted the pilot, and it was really well received, except then, you know, the execs came to me and said, you know what, this show really has potential, but I think it would be great to just have some talking heads in it. I think it would be great if we could go into their studio. So for the next show, because it got green lit, we'll go to New York and, you know, do some interviews with some designers. And I was like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted to do. So we went to New York and we visited Bob Mackie's studio and Betsy Johnson. I remember we did a big profile piece on Roots Boys. And that was the birth of fashion television. That went over remarkably well. And then we just started churning out this incredible series. We did 39 episodes a year for 27 years. I mean, a lot of shows. And we worked our tails off and traveled all over the world and just had the grandest time. And it really was the first window onto that glamorous world for so many kids, especially who were growing up, you know, in the boonies or growing up in, you know, in rural places and places that really didn't have You know, they weren't exposed to fashion in that way before. And all of a sudden, and especially like a lot of the gay kids started thinking, wow, maybe there is a place for me in that world. You know, I think we really showed them that there were incredible possibilities and there were fabulous people out there that didn't, you know, sort of conform to a lot of the, you know, the norms.
And you helped to give them a voice, those queer LGBT fashion designers.
Yeah. I mean, that has been my biggest joy, to think that so many of the fashion arbiters in the world today that grew up watching that show became industry professionals, you know, whether they were designers or makeup artists or hairdressers or fashion show producers or photographers, some of the models. I mean, so many of these kids that grew up with that show was like a lifeline for them. And a lot of people have come up to me and said, you know, that show kind of saved me. Like it kind of, you know, saved my life. I know that sounds pretty grandiose. I mean, I don't want to take credit for that, but I think just being able to see themselves in our show, in a sense, and to be able to see that there were possibilities and there was a place for them in the outside world, I think that really meant a lot. And boy, that touches me every time I hear those stories.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
Hi there, I'm Bennett Singer, a documentary filmmaker and the co-director of the new film Cured. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Jeannie Becker, I think it's fair to say that what goes really well with fashion is music. And you were just talking about fashion television, but coming from the new music that ran from 1979 to 2008, you and A1, J.D. Roberts at the time, the two of you co-hosted this it was a groundbreaking show. And what are some of the memories? What are some of the situations or the individuals from where you are today, looking back on your time on the new music? What stands out to you? Are there situations, people?
Too many, Mark, too many. I have to say, that's like one of the questions that sort of like get my back up a bit about, because I've had such an extraordinary life. Such an extraordinary run with these two remarkable, groundbreaking shows, as you say, at a time when
it was on the cutting edge.
Making it up as we went along.
Exactly.
You know, there were no rules. So we did things in such an unconventional way, again, thanks to the brilliance of Moses Neimer and the genius John Martin, who really stylistically gave us the inspiration for the way we did the new music, because it was very irreverent and it was very in your face. And we would go out with like me and a cameraman. That was it. Rarely went anywhere with a producer or with any kind of like audio guys or lighting guys or anything. It was just like a cameraman and me. Sometimes JD and I went out together to do a story because we'd be, you know, jealous fighting over, you know, no, I want to interview Bob Geldof. No, I want to interview Bob Geldof. You know, they said, okay, you can both go do it. But for the most part, it was really, you know, this incredible one-man band operation. When you talk about like the cameraman was it, shooting these incredible scenarios and these people, the rock stars, who weren't used to being on TV, because we started that show in 1979. That was pre-MTV. Mm-hmm. MTV wasn't even a thing. And the only other music shows that were on TV at the time were shows like Shindig, Hullabaloo, Dick Clark, American Bandstand, Top of the Pops in the UK. And for shows like that, you know, the musician would come on into the studio and would perform, and then a DJ type person would come and interview them for a few minutes. But we were riding on the smoky tour buses with these musicians. We were going into the studios with them. We were hanging out in their hotel rooms with them. We were, you know, I mean, the scenarios were just incredibly fantastic. You know, I interviewed Andy Summers in a bathtub, you know, like, well, actually, at the time, I was just sitting on the ledge of the bathtub. He was in the bathtub. Years later, I got into the bathtub with him for a fashion television story, but that's a whole other thing. You know, so a lot of these stories, you know, I've written about in my book. I have a book that just came out last fall called Heart on My Sleeve.
Stories from a life, a well-worn life, your
stories
memoir.
Stories from a life well-worn, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, so there, I put a lot of those stories out there. There's still many, 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 many more to be told. But I really got a chance to get up close and personal with some of my childhood idols. You know, whoever thought that I'd be, you know, conversing with Paul McCartney or Keith Richards or Roger Daltrey or Robert Plant or, you
or
know,
Iggy like Pop?
Incredible. Oh, Iggy, wow, that's a whole other story. Yeah, read the book for the lowdown on that one. But, you know, I really had a most magical time doing that show, the new music. It was just a laugh. It was crazy. It was beyond my wildest fantasies.
Did this all start for you on CBC Radio in St. John's, Newfoundland?
Well, my media career definitely started there in a way. I mean, I started acting professionally with a CBC sitcom, actually, TV sitcom called Toby back in 1968. And then, you know, I went off to New York to study acting, and I was getting parts in commercials and a few TV movies different shows. But I really got into this very strange art form called mime.
Mime.
And I went to study mime in
Paris, France.
In 1973, 1974, because I hated the sound of my voice. Mm. I thought it was irritating. And probably some people still think it might be. And I really loved the idea of corporal expression and the idea of pure communication and the idea of really mastering a technique. And in mime, you either create the illusion or you don't. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And it's such a pure form of communication, like so beyond words. So I went to study that. Then I moved back to Toronto. In 1975, I ended up with this guy that I was, you know, he had been my boyfriend for a couple of years, really, and we were madly in love. And he got the chance to do postgraduate work in folklore at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland. And, you know, he said, hey, want to go to Newfoundland with me? And I was like, you know, well, if you marry me, I'll go. And he was like, okay, we got married and we moved to Newfoundland the next day. This was in 1975. And here I was, the only mime artist in the province. And, I, you know, it's like, I thought, okay, I better get myself a real job because I don't think this is necessarily going to help pay the rent. So I thought, what do I know a lot about? I know a lot about the arts. You know, I studied acting in New York and I'd studied mime in Paris and I'd studied theater at university. So I pitched myself as an arts reporter at CBC Radio and they went for it. And this was before CBC was covering the arts. I know now it's like, wow, that's mostly what they cover. But in those days, they weren't they were covering things like, you know, the fisheries and the oil refineries, and they were doing consumer shows. But I pitched myself as an arts reporter because there's such a lively art scene going on in St. John's, and it just took off. So I worked there for 3 years, and then when I came back to Toronto in 1978 with an arsenal of, you know, radio tapes, and I'd done all this wonderful work for CBC Radio, I got hired by Chum Radio, 1050 Chum, which was the great station that I grew up listening to as a kid. And they hired me as their good news girl. And that was the year that they bought this funky little cable station called City TV. So they wanted to cross promote their personalities. And I was the chick, and J.D. Roberts, who was the boss jock at the time, now John Roberts of Fox News.
Fox News, hello.
yeah, so we went over to the TV side of things, and that's how the whole thing happened.
A love letter to fashion, Brian Adams. Jeannie Becker was my first fashion guru, Kim Cattrall. Just a quick couple quotes from your 2024 memoir, Heart on My Sleeve, Stories from a Life Well Worn. Okay, whether it's CBC Radio or the new music or fashion television or Style Matters on the Shopping Channel that you're doing to this day, or studying mime in Paris, France, here's my last question for you, Jeannie Becker, and it's simply this. What has made the most impact on you? What would you say? Is it the things that you've done professionally? Is it your family? Is it individuals that you've come across on your journey through the tapestry that is your life? For you, what has made the most impact on Jeannie Becker, would you say?
Well, I mean, Mark, truly all of the above. I mean, of course, the people that have, you know, grown up watching me, the people that I have met in my career, some of the greatest, you know, luminaries in entertainment and fashion. And certainly, you know, my family is just, you know, like, you know, means so incredibly much to me. But I really must say that I think the cancer journey that I was on a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2022, that had an incredible impact on me because that made me really see life for what it is and made me understand just how tough I could be and that I was a survivor after all and that I did have the right attitude to get me through it. And that gave me a lot of kind of a lot of belief in myself You know, I knew that the journey, as daunting and scary as it was initially, would make me a bigger, better, bolder, braver, wiser, more courageous person. And I think it did. And then being able to share my journey so publicly as I did with all my followers, my Instagram followers, that was such a heart-swelling experience. I mean, all these people that reached out to me with their prayers and their good wishes and their own personal stories just filled my heart to such a degree and really restored my faith in humanity. It really was a journey that was just filled with so many silver linings, and I met so many incredibly inspiring people as a result. And even to this day, I work very closely with Princess Margaret Cancer Center. And I just can't do enough for that place. I think of it as my temple of healing, that incredible place. It's really a port in the storm for so many of us who not only have lived with cancer, but have, you know, perhaps survived it, because it's something that never really leaves you, you know, once you go through it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's I think maybe what's had the most impact on me.
Jeannie Becker, well said, well done, well lived. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Mark. Such a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Mark, so nice talking to you. Sorry, I talked so much, right? You're a former mime artist. It's like I'm making it the last time. I never shut up now.
I love your Order of Canada pin. Well done.
Oh, I wear it like my best accessory. My best accessory.
That was my spotlight on award-winning broadcaster Jeannie Becker. By the way, her memoir, Heart on My Sleeve, Stories from a Life Well Worn, is available wherever you get your favorite books. Coming up next, Parade.
Hi, I'm songwriter and producer Jim Valance, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, award-winning filmmakers Noam Gonick and Justine Pimlott fills us in on their new Canadian documentary, Parade, Queer Acts of Love and Resistance, a documentary about Canada's 2S LGBTQ+ movement.
Well, the film is about, it's a history of the 2S LGBTQ+ movement in Canada. We don't say it's the definitive history, but it's a selection of milestones that Justine and I have culled from, you know, the history of this country's movement starting in the early 60s and coming up until today.
Mm. Justine, you are a producer on this documentary. The opening 3 minutes of this film, I found rather powerful. We're seeing images, we're hearing voiceovers. Talk to me about those first, about 3 minutes and how that came to be.
Yeah, it is very powerful. A film is, you know, made by collaboration, and certainly for Noam and I, one of our key collaborators was our editor, Ricardo Costa. And we, you know, at the beginning, you start off, you know, together, Noam and I, me as producer and Noam as director. And then you kind of expand from there as you build the team. And then you expand, and then you shrink down again. And then it becomes just you and the director and the editor working together. So those 3 minutes was very much of an intense process collaboration between Noam as director, Ricardo as editor, myself as producer, where we really wanted to, in that 3 minutes, give you a sense of the sweep, the incredible sweep, the incredible power of the stories that you were about to, that were about to unfold before your eyes as you started to watch the rest of the film play out. So it really was trying to give the audience a sense of the span in terms of timeline, but the power of the stories and the power of our community and who is part of our community and the diversity of our community. Noam, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Noam, well, actually, here's the question, Noam. Was that always the intent to start the documentary the way that it does start? Was that always the plan?
Well, the plan was always that the film was going to be made up of a lot of archival imagery. So those first 2 minutes leans heavily into some historic film and video. Much of it called from the National Film Board archives. Justine and I always knew that this film would be a collage, and much of it would be relying on these this incredible, incredible archival library that we had access to because we were an NFP film. So you see old vintage parades from the early 60s. These weren't pride parades. These were just public parades, Victoria Day parades and whatnot across the coast, agricultural parades. So you really start thinking about this idea of parade. And then towards the end of that opening few minutes, you see other kinds of parades, protest parades, rallies, and that kind of thing. People who've stepped off the sidewalk and into the street and are making their demands. So it kind of morphs. And it's sort of kind of, Justine, I remember you wanted to really be like an encapsulation of the film. And, you know, I think those intros, what do you call it, the first 2.5 minutes before the title, is it's really to let people know what the ride is that they're going to, you know, settle into for the next, you know, 90 odd minutes.
Mark, how did you feel? How did you feel when you watched it? That 2.5 minutes just
to start. I thought it was great because for me, it sets the tone, and it was documentaries are, you know, they can be powerful, but those first few minutes of a documentary really hopefully pulls in the viewer, and this one truly does. It also features LGBT, some well-known LGBT individuals like musician Lorraine Zagato from the Parachute Club, former member of parliament Sven Robinson, activist and actually friend of Rainbow Country, Tim McCaskill. Noam, talk to me about the process of deciding who would be featured in the documentary. How did this come about in regards to some of the talking heads that you have in the film?
Well, I mean, we started off with a long list, Justine and I. There was a lot of reading of books in the research and development phase, including Tim McCaskill's book. And we sort of made our, you know, wish list. And then we reached out to these people, and we would have Zooms just like this, long, long Zooms that were recorded. And then we would sort of meet, Justine and I, and then later with Ricardo, and say, you know, who we thought could speak to what. You know, sometimes we spoke to fantastic individuals, but maybe there were lots of people who could speak to certain moments of the history. So it was almost like a curatorial thing where you sort of decide who would be best to speak to what. And it didn't end after that initial list. I mean, this was an extended production process, and there were times, you know, we'd look at a cut of the film, we'd think, you know, we don't have all of the story. We need to go back and find other people to give that story more complexity and depth. We're just hitting the surface right now. So we'd go back and do more research. And we had great researchers on the film who were deeply connected to various aspects of the community, be it trans, lesbian, the BIPOC community. We had an incredible team of researchers to help us make those connections.
As young activists, we had a vision. We wanted a world that was free of homophobia.
This was a joyous, profoundly political event.
We made a point. We're here, we're queer, we're in your face.
The straight world wanted us to be invisible.
Homosexuality was essentially illegal.
You could get 8 years in prison or a mental institution.
We're fed up with paying the price of other people's hang-ups. There's no homosexual problem in Canada. There's a heterosexual problem.
This is a time that requires that we be on the street to take up space.
The state would attack us. We were forced to respond. There was no choice.
You didn't know what kind of level of violence was going to take place. Everyone had to dig into a level of courage.
Direct action, of spontaneous action, of people-led action.
Backlash is upon us.
It is a time to stand up, and I'm really proud of those youth around the world who are standing up to this patriarchy, to this fascism.
It's just a really beautiful thing to think about all of the people who have stepped off of the sidewalk and into the road. This is that genealogy of resistance.
Parade. Queer Acts of Love and Resistance is out now. And you can watch it at tvo.org. Just search Parade. Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, a track that was the theme song for the groundbreaking TV show, The New Music. The 1981 song from British punk band, Pig Bag. The track? Papa's got a brand new pig bag.
What should you listen to make your Monday mornings that much better? Absolutely Frivolous on CFRC 101.